All right, well, thank you. Let's get going. A real honor to have a chance to talk to such a distinguished group of friends and colleagues. I'm going to be talking today about a new experiment called Anita, which I think is going to be one of these ideas that's going to turn out to be good. In the same sense that when we did Amanda about 15 years ago, it was one of those ideas where it wasn't clear that it would work, but it had enough potential that we really started to pursue all the requirements to make it turn it into an experiment, and that turned out to be quite a challenge, but it worked. And now it's evolved into this very beautiful project called IceCube. So we're hoping for the same kind of good luck with Anita, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I think it's going to go that way, what we can do with it, and it's still evolving, so a lot of this is, you know, ideas that are initially...
If there are lights on the board, maybe.
Oh, you want the lights turned down somehow?
Make it easier to appreciate your diagram.
Oh, they'll come back later. A little bit better. All right, this one's really bright.
This.
Thank you. Okay, so this experiment is not overly large yet. It involves universities and JPL that you see here on the board. And so the first thing I'll try to do is go over the motivation of why we're building such an instrument, and then we'll try to tell you how we're doing in terms of building it and constructing it. So as you probably have heard several times by now, neutrinos are an interesting particle. They're really one of these things that are extremely useful in ways that are quite obvious when you think about it. They're stable and yet weakly interacting. So if you're going to look for deviations from the standard model, this is an ideal probe for that, because unlike with particle physics where you're looking for very rare instances of something bizarre happening, here you can see it right at the primary cross-section. So this is a remarkable complementary technique to searching for physics beyond the standard model. The other thing you can do with these things is to look for sources in the sky, so you can use them as astronomical messengers. And this kind of plot, which you've probably seen with Francis and probably with Doug in the future, is the point is that neutrinos can come to us from anywhere in the universe, essentially from any energy. So even if you're not overly clever like I am, you don't care about where the sources are. You just believe that somehow neutrinos are going to be created somewhere, and if they are going to get to you unimpeded, unlike other probes that you could use, like protons, where you largely have to be at extremely high energies to use them as a way to determine what the target or determine the source. And photons are largely restricted to fairly low energies, low in the sense of 10 TeV or so, so that you can't really use them as an extragalactic probe beyond that. So that's the opportunity. So if you're going to globally identify what neutrinos are good for, you can use them as probes and you can use them as a way to look for sources that are not obvious in any other waveband. So for one of the ways that we might think of using high-energy neutrinos is to look for extensions beyond the standard model. So here is a set of curves by Ankerdoki et al., where they predict cross-section enhancements due to micro-black hole production at a certain energy scale. And once the energy scale is reached, or the scale size of the extra dimension is reached, the cross-section transitions from weak scale to essentially a Schwarzschild radius to geometric effect. And you can see that these cross-sections grow by several orders of magnitude over the standard model. Now, where this cross-section reaches its sort of maximum deviation or its largest extent is in an energy range somewhere between 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20 electron volts. And that's an interesting range for us, because that's where we expect most of the GZK neutrinos that we'd be detecting with Anita to occur. So this provides an energy band of neutrinos that's well constrained that we can use to look for deviations from cross-section, and this kind of thing is something that we would use as a signature and look for that in the detector. And I'll try to tell you how we're going to do that at the end of the talk. The big problem with GZK neutrinos, or those neutrinos produced by the collisions of cosmic rays with the cosmic ray background, is that there's not many of them. It's a relatively secure source, but there's just not very many of them. So a plot like this, where we plot the flux times an energy scale, or in this case E squared, on this axis, and then on this axis just the energy of the neutrino. All these curves are basically models of some sort or another, but this big green blob here represents the variations of GZK models that are appearing in the literature. So you can see there's a fairly large band of uncertainty in terms of just the number of models that are out there. But the thing you also should pay attention to is that at 10 to the 18 electron volts, this is sort of where you'd expect your peak flux, then you have to look at this red band and then use this red band and look over here, and this tells you the scale size of your detector to get of order 10 events per energy decade. And on this case, you know, if you're looking at 10 to the 18 in this region of the peak, then you have to look over here and it's around 1,000 kilometer cube steradian years. That's the scale size you need. So you really need an enormous exposure. You need a large technique. And so I'm going to try to describe a way that we expect to go up to those scales.
What kind of model is 10 to the minus 6?
I'm sorry, what?
What kind of model was it that gives 10 to the minus 6 anything?
It was one of these where they really promote all the, there's no model, it was just tuning all these parameters like the evolution and energy spectrum and all these kinds of parameters that people, you know, utilize, and they just push them to the point where they can be without being experimentally excluded. And so those are the ones that drive you way up to these things. Okay, so the detector that we're going to build looks similar to this. It's a series of radio antennas. And so what we're going to be looking for is a Cherenkov pulse, just like we use in a MANDA and an ice cube, but now down in the radio wavelengths where the radio will propagate from the interaction point in the ice out through the ice and then to our detector sitting in a balloon. So this kind of array of antennas, these are all quad-ridge antennas, we'll be sitting on a balloon which sits at around 40 kilometers looking over a very large patch of ice. So this red here represents the viewing distance that you can see on Antarctica. This is the Antarctic continent, which is a very big place, and you can see a sizable fraction of Antarctica from 40 kilometers up. So if you take a look at sort of the average viewing size, it's about 1.1 million cubic kilometers because the average depth is about 1 kilometer deep. So this project started its funding back in 2003, and I'll tell you about a prototype instrument that we launched back in December of 2003, and then I'll talk about where we're going to try to go with the full-fledged Anita instrument, which is scheduled for launch in December 2006, and we're now got a flight launch window for that.
And that previous to that transparency in which you had, you were supposed to translate the exposure you needed. Mm-hmm. Is this, I'm confused now whether you included or not included the neutrino interaction probability. Is this the, so this is sort of the physical size of the thing, assuming what kind of material?
Well, meters of water equivalent, something like that. Ice is about that. You need a big detector to get these GZK points. Okay, so the idea then is to look for neutrinos. Now, these energies that we're expecting the GZK neutrinos to be at, they don't go through the Earth anymore. So you have to look either in the downgoing direction or across the horizontal direction. And so this is the technique that we primarily utilize, which are these horizontal going neutrinos. That way they encounter the most ice in the traveling, and therefore they'll interact somewhere in the ice. And so we expect the interaction to occur in the ice sheet, create a cascade of particles. Those cascade of particles create a radio pulse, which then propagates through the ice, hits the surface, and refracts out to the balloon. The nice thing, or the thing that the property that we're taking advantage of, is that ice was expected to be extremely good in terms of its attenuation length at radio wavelengths. We expected that because people who map Antarctica to figure out how deep it is, where the land is, all these kinds of geographic information they've been using for decades, and they know a lot about how the radio propagates through the ice. The other nice thing about this is that because you're going through a lot of ice and because the energies are very high, you're essentially immune to the cross-section, at least for these kinds of neutrinos. They're basically going to interact somewhere. The interaction length is about 200 kilometers at these energies. and just about all quartz passing through the Earth give you about 200 kilometers. And you can't deviate very much from the horizontal because this angle that's produced, the Cherenkov cone, is actually the complement of the total internal reflection angle at the surface here. So you're almost constrained to never see any events because the Cherenkov cone goes up and then you might expect it to be totally internally reflected, but because of the finite width of the cone, you actually get a little of the off-axis power sneaking out through the ice. It's not very much, though. Now, this effect of producing a radio pulse has been confirmed by experiments done by Peter Gorham and David Salzberg and others up at SLAC, and this is the results that they get. This is the line is the expected shower development along the axis. What they did is they essentially dumped a large number of photons into a big pile of sand, and then they watched the shower develop and look at the radio pulse with a very simple antenna. They didn't even need an amplifier. It was like, you know, in the old days where you just get 300 volt pulses coming out at the attenuator. And then they followed the development of this thing, and they saw that it matched the modeling very well. This was the time profile of the pulse. As you can see, it's only occurring over a very short time scale, essentially 2 nanoseconds. And this is also involved with the response of the antenna. The basic pulse that comes out is something on the order of 100 to 150 picoseconds wide. So it's a very, very short pulse, and we really can take advantage of that in radio. The other nice thing about Cherenkov is that it's 100% linearly polarized, and that's what they verified right here. This is the percent polarization, and it's 100% linearly polarized until you start getting reflections off the wall, then it starts getting a little mushy. But we can't take advantage of that in optical, but you can in radio, because it's a very simple matter of just building an antenna that looks at this polarization and this polarization. With optical, it's more complicated, and so we typically don't use that feature. They also confirmed that this radio pulse scaling works over a large range of energy. It actually goes as the energy of the neutrino squared, so it rises very rapidly between energies of 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 19, but they see this E squared scaling very cleanly.
Which are these points?
These are points that they've taken at SLAC.
10 to 19 dB?
Well, what they've done is they've converted it, right? They start with a large number of photons, so they don't actually start with one particle, but just a blast of particles that then continue to shower. And so if you just count the equivalent energy, it goes from here to there. It doesn't start with a single energy particle. Okay, so that's sort of the motivation. We think the technique will work. Now you got to do the hard work and see if it really will work in Antarctica. So the first thing we wanted to do was measure the ambient noise, what our backgrounds are going to be. So you get out, drive away from the South Pole Station and stick some antennas down. You point them towards the sun, you point them down, you point them up, and take a look at what the ambient noise, see if there's any bizarre behavior. And the initial test taken a few years ago, this is 126.03, showed that the ambient noise was consistent with the minus 40 degree thermal noise from the temperature of the ice. The next thing you want to take a look at is the attenuation length, make sure it's really long. So we did that next, from 200 megahertz to 700 megahertz. We found some antennas on the top of one of these buildings that are down there and pointed them down and fired the radio pulse from this one. It reflects off the bottom rock and then comes back up and into this one. And you essentially make an echogram where you take a look at the amount of power versus time, which we then convert to depth, for various frequencies, the 220 all the way up to 650. And where the ground is, you see there's that spike right there and all those. So that's the bottom of the NR. By seeing this reflection, by knowing how much power you're putting in and how much power gets reflected back, you can infer what the attenuation is as a function of frequency.
Can you see it at the high frequency?
Yeah, it's a little thing right there, yeah. It's pretty small. Yeah, well, the fact that it's right in the right place is our best evidence.
So this reflection would allow to measure ongoing neutrinos?
Yeah, I'll get to all that, yeah.
What is this continuous component does it show the scattering in the ice?
Yeah, right, this is, all this is... Well, you know, as the ice is laid down, there's all these small density contrasts.
You can estimate the attenuation length of layer from this data.
Yeah, except, you know, this is all saturating our amplifier, so there's some nonlinear response in here. We're mostly confident of what's going on right here, so it's... This is all at the thermal noise level, but up here, these are pretty big signals, and they're starting to saturate our amplifiers. We try to work out numbers, but we're not sure about what we're doing here. Now, of course, when you push the signal straight down, you're going through different temperature ice. It's much colder at the surface than it is at the bottom. And there's a strong temperature dependence on the attenuation length. So the number that you measure on these reflection studies is some kind of average value over the entire temperature profile. If you then combine that with the expected temperature profile at the South Pole, you can then infer what it would be at minus 50, which is sort of the typical temperature that you get over much of Antarctica. So this is kind of a good baseline temperature. This is mostly dominated by the fact that when you get very close to the bottom, there's a very strong warming trend, and the attenuation length depends exponentially with temperature. So this is largely dominated by the very small length of warm ice. Now we also have to make some estimate of how much power gets reflected off the bottom, and for that we just decided to be as conservative as we could. Whenever we're making an estimate of this thing, we said, well, the antennas are essentially 100% efficient. The power, there's no losses in our cable, which we know is all false. And so that, but the main thing is you have to make an estimate of how much power gets reflected off the bottom. And we took the number as just basically the index of refraction mismatch, which puts it at about 8% reflected power. If you talk to experts who study reflection off the bottom, they say it's more like the reflection coefficient is more like 30 dB or 3 orders of magnitude. So in fact, we're actually underestimating this number, but probably a factor of 50%. So this actually can be bigger, but it's unlikely to be much smaller than this factor. That'll be important as I come back to this later on. Okay, so then after we got this encouraging news about the ice, we wanted to go and check to see if there was any other transient backgrounds or sources of RF that might kill us. After all, the military doesn't tell us everything about the sources that might be down there. So we wanted to fly an instrument just to make sure it's quiet. So we flew Anita Light, which was nothing more than two of these antennas that we expect to fly in an Anita. And it's piggybacking along with another instrument called Tiger, which launched in December of 2003. And the problem with that, and we had very good success with the Tiger folks, but we had no real control of the radio backgrounds that are, in fact, Tiger has photomultiplier tubes, which are excellent sources of radio noise. So we have to set our thresholds a bit higher than we would in full Anita. This is what the instrument looks like just prior to launch. We have a big truck putting up on the back of that. And then you launch it, and it flies around Antarctica. In this particular mission, it went about 1 1/4 wraps around Antarctica. It launches here and ends up right there. So it stayed up for 18 days, and it took about 100,000 triggers. Make sure the instrument was running. We pointed it at the sun. Well, sort of rotated freely, so it saw the sun on occasion. And when it was pointing towards the sun, we saw, in fact, an increase in the radio signal. From the combination of the sun and the galactic center, which also happened to be in that same region of the sky. So we saw that, which allowed us to confirm that the basic instrumentation was running properly. We also sent signals from McMurdo up to the instrument, so we had a transmitter on the surface, and we blasted it different frequencies and different pulse durations up to the instrument while it was up at the top of the atmosphere. And so what we could do is actually plot the azimuthal angle as determined by the sun sensors. So we knew exactly which way we were pointing based on where the sun was, and based on the time difference of arrival of the signal from those two antennas. And so that's what this correlation plot looks like right here. And from that, we can infer the timing resolution based on this antenna design to be about 120 picoseconds, so 0.12 minutes, which translates to an angular resolution from the timing alone of a half a degree and an azimuthal resolution of a couple of degrees, just from timing. Then you take a look at the signals, and this is sort of what you get. Those 100,000 triggers are not neutrinos, they're something else. And so what you want to take a look at is the pulses. So this represents a typical record, horizontal, vertical, one of the antennas, and the horizontal, vertical polarization of the other antenna. As again, the expected signal on this scale looks like this. It's very short in duration. Because of the filters, you get some wiggling out to about 30 nanoseconds. But this is what we get, this is what we see, and since this does not look like that, it's very easy to see that this is not going to be a neutrino event. You actually go through and find all the different backgrounds, the 100,000, and all the 100,000, interesting enough, basically fall into five categories, of which I show four. So there's these kind of long duration blasts, there's these kind of circular polarized things, there's glitches that where you see this double structure, and then there's the just the kind of a mush thing. This is what you expect to see. So this is an injected pulse. This isn't real, but this gets put on top of the RF background. So on this scale of minus 100 to plus 100, it's a very short pulse. If you blow it up, then it looks a little bit cleaner. But this is what we'd expect to see. Nothing looks like that. So essentially, by arguing that we have five distinct classes of events, they all look very similar, they're all due to something that we could identify, then we were able to say that there's actually no signal in our, just from the fact that they're very long and they all look identical. So once you say that you look through all the 100,000 events and you see no events that look like you'd expect, then you can say there's no neutrinos, but then what does that mean? So you have to develop a Monte Carlo. And the Monte Carlo...
That's a question of the previous. Do you know what those five things are?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us? Or?
Yeah, I can. They're all details. Okay.
Sorry. Just nice to know.
So because we had no control over what we were flying with,
So Tiger
is one of those, yeah. And then there's also the NSBF communication. You have to communicate, because after all, you're flying away, pretty far away from McMurdo, and once you leave line of sight, you have to telemetry it all by TDRS. So there's TDRS, you know, there's TDRS signals that we have to deal with. And we tried to veto all these things, but they're just big, powerful. So that's this thing. The SIP glitch comes from the TDRS. This general long mush comes from, say, the switching of the, you have to power the instrument somehow, and the way you power it is through the solar panels, but they also have batteries, so there's this kind of switching between battery and solar panel in some instances, and that switching was really noisy for us.
What are the two categories that you're not showing us, Steve?
Well, this one's signal, yeah, and this, so the circular pulse here is something on the payload, but
there's nothing outside the instrument. No ion.
As far as we can tell, no.
What about like ionosphere?
As far as we can tell, no.
Alan is asking.
These frequencies are pretty high. I mean, there's somewhere between, you know, we're turning on around 200 megahertz and it's up to gigahertz.
But the circular polarized one, if it wasn't circularly polarized, would you get something fused or?
No, this is again very long.
It's very wide. Alan is asking about the other.
This is every event covered in six categories, four shown here.
Two secret ones.
Oh, well, I just didn't have enough space. So I'll send them to you. I don't know. I mean, but they all look something odd. I mean, there were clearly nothing that looked anything like that.
Where are the field lines connected above?
Do
they connect at some location?
The magnetic field lines?
Yes.
Yeah, they connect. No. Well, I mean, there was no real strong weather when we were flying there, and as far as I remember, there was no storm. Is that what you were asking? Some kind of odd weather pattern?
I'm just thinking the whistler.
They have to go through the pole, right?
Yeah.
Good to know where it is.
So once you eliminate all the background, you do the modeling. It turns out that a needle light with its two instruments follows this curve, the full Anita with the same Monte Carlo that was used to fit for the full configuration. The instrument follows this curve. So what's nice about Anita is you can see that it turns on about, well, whatever you want to call turn on, but it reaches 100 kilometer cubed steradian down at just around 10 to the 210 to the 18. Which is, you know, if you're looking for transient sources, then it's nice. But if, since we're only up there for a tenth of the year, you know, we don't have a full year's coverage. Based on the Anita light curves, though, we can develop a limit. The fact that we flew for 7 days live time, the efficiency for the analysis turned out to be about 0.6 of the signals would pass our rejection cuts. And so by putting all that kind of stuff in there, you develop this curve right here. And so this was what we released in the recent ATS meeting at Tampa. And what we can see is that the various remnants of the ZBurst model, where people were trying to tune things away to still survive all the other constraints on the model, left them with these fairly low fluxes here at fairly specific energies, and we're quite a bit below that right now. So it's no longer some kind of marginal exclusion. It's we don't think we're there. Now this, of course, means that these models were tuned to try to explain any kind of trans-GZK events. I mean, if there's some source of high-energy neutrinos that aren't quite as big as you need to get the trans-GZK, well then this process still should happen, but it might happen at a much lower rate.
I assume you're addressing Tom Weiler there, not me.
Yes.
Well, you could be sorry too, I don't know. I just came back from Northwestern and Tom was there. And
do I still correct it that Anita peak lights just comes from the longer exposure time?
Right. Well, it's also a bigger instrument, as you saw on the other.
Because there's a, you improve orders of magnitude.
Yeah. So the combination of the fact that we're, in this, basically we're assuming 45 days, somehow we're going to get.
But this goes square root of time, so it cannot be.
Why is it square root of time?
I mean, the sensitivity goes square root of time.
It's zero vector.
Okay, then linearly.
Yeah.
So then you improve, so you get toward the longer exposure time?
Well, if we fly for 45 days, I mean, for one thing, you know, the reason, one of the reasons why it was so different, as I don't know, one of the reasons why this is so different, because we had to set our thresholds on Anita Light very high, because we're right next to this big booming noise source from Tiger. So that sort of suppresses this effective volume stradian that we, because we had to set our thresholds 4.5 sigma above noise source.
I have a question. I don't understand about the emission mechanism. This lady, what's Chernobyl? You mentioned Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
And it is coming from an electromagnetic component, is it right?
Mm-hmm.
Any electromagnetic component. Mm-hmm. Do you take into account the LPM effect?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. But you know.
It makes it weaker.
So it may, yeah, for the electron neutrinos, yeah. Yeah, it really suppresses the signal there.
Mm-hmm. No, no,
but for muon and tau.
My question is, LPM effect make the signal weaker.
Yes. We account for it, but it, what I'm saying is it mostly affects the electron neutrino. And if you have any questions, the expert's sitting right there. Okay, so anyway, the Anita sensitivity then projected in 45 days is this curve as you looked at. Again, this now goes down to a large fraction of the available GZK models. The bottom one is one of the more, you call it conservative, but one of the lower ones that you present in yours and the SECL. And
more realistic one.
If you want to call it realistic, yeah. Okay. But anyway, we'll be getting of order 5 or 6 events.
So is that the ones without the evolution?
With
it's
with a relatively small amount of evolution.
Sure, by E,
yes. That's what's missing there somehow. Oh, it's C log E. No, that's right. That's fine. So this is D5, D-log E, so it's E times the...
Yeah, but you have the same multiplied by the number factor.
Yeah.
Can you show?
Not right now. But we do have it, yes.
Working backwards from, just to make sure, working backwards from number of events, the lower one must be like the NL set of standard blocks, right? So it could be a factor then lower.
Oh, yeah.
Just be prepared.
That could be hard too, if it's unusual.
Why do you have more apology? Chuck, how did you want to see it solved?
We wanted E squared.
E squared, yeah. In fact, I prefer E V because we're sending the second derivative.
Oh.
Some people have biased to G.
We'll bias to E squared.
E squared plus the...
No, we can make, you know, whatever.
You have a subdivision.
We can multiply by E, don't worry.
This subdivision comes from the collection areas of weights, I mean, you know, in susceptibility.
Yes.
So because of collection areas of weights. You see this coming the constant level.
Yes.
So what is the reason I'm asking? This is because collection area?
Yeah, right. We were starting to, and in fact, that these energies, if we could see further, it would help us. But we just reached the horizon at 40 kilometers.
Yeah, don't you see triangle dimension from normal horizontal cosmic ray showers? Protons.
Yeah, so what's the problem?
This is coherent triangle, isn't it? It's coherent emission.
It's radio coherent emission.
It's proton inducing neutrinos.
We have many cosmic rays.
So you can point to the ice.
Yeah. So the first thing is, you know, you can point to the ice.
It's ice.
But you can point to the ice.
If it's
so, even if it is in the atmosphere, you should jam up on them.
And there's also the fact that,
yes.
And we also will use the frequency content. You know, the frequencies that we're looking at are essentially 200 megahertz to 1 gigahertz. Whereas in the atmosphere, okay, so and that frequency band is driven by the fact that we're in a dense medium, so the molecular radius doesn't get very large in the shower development. But as you go into the atmosphere, the density is much lower, so the molecular, you know, expands out, and so the coherent frequencies tend to be much lower and below our band pass. Okay, so that was the basic result. That was the first basic result we presented at the APS meeting. This is the second idea that we presented at the APS meeting, and that has to do with trying to measure the cross-section at very high energies. So what I've been talking about all along right now is just the neutrino that comes in horizontally, produces the Cherenkov pulse and then gets refracted out of the ice. Of course, there's going to be some power that goes down and hits the bottom and then gets reflected up, and we've been ignoring that so far. Now what we're trying to do is study what's going to happen to these neutrinos that basically come in from the down, from the upward direction down into the ice, which then create the Cherenkov pulse that then reflects off the bottom and then comes up through the ice and refracts out. And we're essentially ignoring this pulse then. So we'll call this a reflected event, and these kinds of events direct. Now you can imagine right away, because this is coming in horizontally, all the events, all the neutrinos are essentially going to interact for most cores of the Earth. So this is largely independent of cross-section, whereas this is very short. This is only a couple of kilometers thick, and so every time you increase the cross-section, you're going to get more opportunity for these neutrinos to interact, and so this is going to depend very strongly on the cross-section. The other nice thing about considering these kinds of events is that it opens up a lot more of the sky that you're sensitive to neutrinos. So this represents the band of what we can see from our instrument for these direct events. And if you then go and include the reflected and direct events, this part of the sky opens up. The scale on this side represents the fraction of events that are in each of these bands. So this represents the 10% level. And this 10% down here comes from the fact primarily that if you have normal cross sections, the reflected events are only about 10% of the direct events. But as we'll see, as the cross sections go up, the fraction of reflected to direct change. But anyway, that's this The message to take away from here is that with the reflected events, it opens up a lot more of the sky. So if you have transient sources, if you have some kind of thing that requires us to look off the plane, off the equatorial plane, then this is a nice thing to.
Do you have galactic coordinates in the picture? Just to see what.
Now that I don't know if I do have. No, I don't think I have that one right now. But you know, this one would be essentially like the Amanda galactic map. So if Francis showed one of those, it would be essentially the same.
This one, about here.
Here it's a much narrower.
Yeah, so
watch.
Much interesting what part is for galactic
thing. Yeah, the only thing I know is it's not close enough to the galactic center.
This is a simulation of Earth's fault.
Well, this is assumed that you have some isotropic flux of neutrinos and where you would then detect
these. The idea basically you get the cross section because you're doing the experiment with two targets, air and ice.
Well, no, we're not using any air at all in this one. It's just it's ice in both cases, but in one case you're using neutrinos that largely only go through this way, which is only a few kilometers of ice, and the other one you're using neutrinos that go through this way, which is 200 kilometers.
But if you have 100 times the cross section, as you showed for these models, the air must start playing.
Oh yeah. We put the attenuation of the air in. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if it's 100 times and you're up at 10 to the 22, yeah, the air starts to attenuate. Yeah. We don't actually count any signal; we just attenuate the signal.
That may be more sensitive actually than doing din and tick tock, which this is.
Well. I suspect now because of the frequency problems.
This is a map of the sun, right? I mean, the southern sky, not the usual Amanda map. It's the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is.
So it's complementary.
It's complementary to whatever we
see.
Yes,
you should see it all.
No, well, for here, yes, but not for here, no.
The bottom.
No. The quality of events reflected and direct will be the same or?
No.
So what?
So I'll get
higher that. Quality are direct, right?
Yes.
So that is so basically it could appear that that one will be the main, I mean if you would go back to the physics or.
Yeah, okay, let me get through some part of this and I'll show you the problems with the reflected and the.
One more question.
Yeah.
Why this plot was not uniform in the ascension?
Why is the what? Not uniform?
It's not uniform in the ascension because of the.
Oh, it has to do with the fact that Antarctica isn't exactly a circle. So, you know, if your balloon is flying out over here, some fraction of your viewing angle is over water, you don't see anything. So there's some variation that way. Okay, so this is how we plan to actually identify direct versus reflected events. We make a model and we see that because the reflection costs you in two ways. You have to go through more ice, right? You have to go down and then back through the ice, and then you have to also take the hit from the bottom reflection. They tend to be much closer to your gondola than the direct events. So that's what this distribution looks like. So this is the reflected distance distribution from your gondola versus direct. So that's one handle we have. And the other is just geography. And it's so easy to see, but there's a clustering of blue events here, and those are the reflected events. And there's sort of a smudge of purplish events. I don't know what color it is. That's sort of our uniform around in Antarctica. So the direct events have very little dependence with the thickness of the ice. As long as it's over about a kilometer thick, we essentially see a uniform distribution. Whereas the reflected events, we need to have a good reflecting bottom. And so it turns out that, you know, the reflection off of water is excellent. It's a nice mirror. And salt water is even better. So the people who study this stuff have measured the reflection off the bottom of the Ross Ice Shelf, and it's only 1 dB. It's virtually no attenuation off the bottom there. We also know the temperature profiles very accurately. In fact, one of the nice things is that the Ross Ice Shelf is one of the most heavily studied regions in Antarctica. So we know a lot about the ice down here. And if you ask the experts, they'll tell you that this is a very hot, bright region for reflected events. So that's the clustering here. You get a kind of similar clustering from the Ronny Ice Shelf. And then the rest of these points are just sort of uniformly smeared out. So by combining the geographic information with the angular information, which is, translates to distance, you can make a likelihood function and differentiate the direct from the reflected events. This distribution happens to be made with 100 times standard model cross, just so you can see the events.
So if you take standard cross sections,
I'll show you the event rates. It's 5% or so for standard model cross-section. So if we have a source that gives us 100 neutrinos, then 5 of them might be coming from us. It might not be that lucky. It also depends on this attenuation length measurement. So I really think we have to go back and do a better job of measuring that. Right now we've published a paper where this lower limit has been in. But so if you take the number that we published, this is kind of the event distribution. If you take a number that's maybe twice as long, okay, I'm not certain it's going to go that big, but just to give you some idea that it does depend on the attenuation length, the clustering is much bigger here. You can see much more of the Ron Ice Shelf is available. And unfortunately, that 80 is right over. There's another cluster here and here. It turns out that there are regions of very, very cold ice in this part of Antarctica, and they'll tend to give you very long attenuation lengths, and you can start picking up events from other regions if you know something about the attenuation length of the ice. So that's a systematic we have to do better in measuring. Okay, so here's to answer your question, Peter. So this is the relative event rates for both reflected and direct as a function of cross-section and units of the standard model cross-section. And so this is 0.1, 1, 10, 100, 1,000. The direct events go like this, and you can see it's fairly insensitive. It's a factors of 2-ish for every factor of 10 in the cross-section, whereas with the reflected events, you get almost linear scaling until you start getting, until the interaction length starts reaching the characteristic size of the thickness of the ice. So this is of order of kilometer, then it starts flattening out. But even here, you can see that it starts to dominate by factors of 2 or 3. So by making a rough measurement of this to this, right, this is the measurement we make, we then have the ability to just read off the cross-section over the energy range that's governed by the GZK. So we don't have a good handle on the energy at this point. It might be 10 to the 19, might be 10 to the 20, in that range. But it's not a cross-section measurement down to 10 to 17. We just don't get any events. So this is nice, because up at these energies, right, the 10 to the 19 to 10 to the 20 electron volts, that translates to center mass energies of 100 TeV, which is at least 3 to 10 times that of LHC, and this is a way to probe beyond the standard model once, you know, in the next 5 years or so. So this is what I find quite exciting, we just now have to make all the necessary measurements to turn it into a real measure and turn it into a real value. Okay, so then in the last 5 minutes, I guess, I'll just tell you how we stand on the construction and just summarize what we find. So we are in the process of building the full ANITA. As I said, it's an array that far more than the two antennas that I showed you in the ANITA light. The ANITA light measurement, I'll just go back to that, only utilized essentially a rough concept of what the pulse shape looked like. That is, it only had a certain number of rings associated with it, and only could last a certain duration. But we really didn't have any kind of detailed assessment of what the pulse should look like. So we didn't do any kind of pulse matching or any kind of filtering in that way. Again, the signal characteristics of the full ANITA flight, though, we have a lot more handles available to us. For example, we could have looked at the linear polarization component, but we just didn't need to with the ANITA light analysis. We also have direction in the ANITA light. We basically had two antennas, so we could look at this direction, but we can't look up down. Whereas in the full ANITA, we will be able to tell if it comes from the ice or not. So maybe we use one, and we have a lot more handles once we get to the full instrument. So I think in terms of background and our handles to look at the background, we're in pretty good shape. And now we're just in the process of constructing the instrument. So I guess just to summarize, I like this idea. If you want to go and look at At the new physics, it's very popular to go to the very highest energy scales and start probing up in that region. And so you can utilize the GZK neutrinos to help you out in that regard. You just need to build a detector big enough to get you some sizable event rates. This ANITA is a good idea because you can essentially scan over 600 kilometers of ice. The last balloon mission flew around for 40 days around Antarctica. So you can stay up for at least a tenth of a year. Energy resolution is pretty darn good because we can tell where the event comes from out of the ice. We have good angular resolution, and so we'll know how it comes out. Then the only uncertainty is how deep it was in the ice, and we saw that the attenuation length of the ice is not very strong. So we're looking at probably of order of unity of energy resolution for the very most distant events, and it's considerably better for the nearby events. We can calibrate the antenna. We can use, as we said, artificial sources, transmitters from McMurdo. We also have plans to put transmitters in the ice. We've identified boreholes just outside of McMurdo, and we'll transmit radio signals through the ice, really check out the refraction characteristics of the ice surface. And let's see, linear polarization. We have lots of handles, so the signal's very clean. So I think it has all the right elements to be a successful experiment. The ANITA light really tested all the electronics, all the systems, all the backgrounds that we're likely to encounter, and so that showed that we're doing a pretty good job from that standpoint. And we're set to go on December 06. So, final outlook. Well, you know, with the development of Amanda 2, we really have, I guess, the necessary tools. We've established the tools to start using neutrinos as a probe for sources in the sky. So multi-messenger astronomy is possible. And then hopefully with IceCube, it really becomes reality. If you want to go to the very highest energy scales and really start probing particle physics in addition to sources, then you have to think about bigger detectors and larger volumes. And so I think one of the promising technologies is this radio Cherenkov. And with ANITA, that's probably the one I'm putting my money on right now, as to pull off the radio Cherenkov. Thanks a lot.
You mentioned that there were going to be three flights, so do you mean that you can recover the thing without it breaking?
Maybe. It's likely that we'll be able to get it back, but not right next year. I mean, you'll get it back, and then you have to bring it back to refurbish, and then you have to relaunch it. So that involves probably at least a 1 or 2 year delay between the first launch and the second launch. So 45 days is sort of our canonical number we've been using. Now, whether we get that in one flight, which is possible, or whether it takes two flights or three, I don't know. That depends on how well this balloon stays up and circles around.
And it lands without being destroyed?
Some fraction of it will be destroyed. Like the solar panels, I think a lot of the beams and tubes are going to get hosed. But the electronics are fairly secure. And so we expect a large fraction to be recoverable. For example, most of the balloon instruments that go down there are recovered and they are refurbished and relaunched. But you always have to build some stuff.
Yeah. The 40-day flight almost landed in the ocean, which would have been a disaster for the flight time, but it came over just in time. And they hadn't sent back a large fraction of their data, so they were sweating bullets for a while. Uh-huh. What fraction of the data can you send back while you're using flight that's of interest?
Well, we expect almost 100%. You're looking for 10 events over 10 days. So the main thing we're going to do is set it to thermal threshold. So we'll be largely governed by what random fluctuations are going to hit our trigger. And then what you can do is start prioritizing those events and send down all the interesting ones. In fact, we did that with ANITA Light. So the prioritization, we now know a lot more about how we're going to do the prioritization. And essentially, every interesting event should be able to.
But then you also be able to get enough of the background.
Oh, yeah. No.
Improvised studies.
Yeah, at least on ANITA Light, we're able to get, of order one event a minute, something like that, sent down. Yeah.
You showed that plot of direct and deflected events, which is very nice. Is that energy dependent?
Yeah, it is. But as you know, depending on what your source of neutrinos are, I mean.
And that was my other question. What if you had AGNs?
If we had AGNs moving away, then all these numbers get better, right? I mean, so when I showed the relative numbers between the reflected versus direct, for example, well, that all works much better if the numbers are up around 100 than if they're down around 5, right? So our ability to measure cross section depends ultimately on the absolute flux.
Okay, so that was the kind of the 8 GeV, the lowest energy threshold that you showed, the one for GZK and for kind of the 8 GeV. Is that the
No. No, they're all for just GZK fluxes. So we've integrated all the events for GZK on those.
Above 10 to the 8 or what?
Well, over the entire energy spectrum. But essentially, our instrument turns off around 10 to the 18, as you saw.
Well, I was thinking your lowest one is 10 to the 8th GeV, right? I'm just trying to understand the energy dependence of the.
I'm trying to figure out.
Okay, so.
So this is 10 to the 18.
Right, so let's talk about GeV, 10 to the 9 GeV. To 10 to the 13. When you showed the direct and reflected, you showed just one.
No, we integrate over this entire energy band for the GZK. So if you have an E to the minus 2, we can put that in there. And, you know.
Okay. Can I ask about your energy resolution? You mentioned what it was. How do you actually get that?
Well, you know where it's coming from, right? So, I mean, we have pretty good directional information. So you know the exit point of the ice. So then it's just a matter of how well you can tell the distance, because it's just the standard 1 over r squared.
The signal is proportional to the energy.
Yeah, the signal is proportional
to the energy squared.
And so that's what they did at SLAC, which was to show that the calculation of the energy could be well mapped to the radio power.
So if you have two orders of magnitude difference, then you expect a different distance for a given angle.
Or just a bigger signal. I mean, we can measure the size of the signal.
So the amplitude of the signal.
Yes.
That's what I was
talking
about. Yeah. So and your lower energy comes from the lowest you could possibly get out of the noise.
Yeah, and for fairly nearby events.
Maybe on this related question, the statements depend on how well you understand, right, what fraction of the radio is actually emitted from the surface.
And so, we're still working on this, what the surface looks like, and this has evolved quite a bit. I don't know how much time I have to go through this, but at first we were quite concerned because of all these sastrugi that are around the surface. It turns out, we got these complicated optical modeling programs, one by Braille, any of these companies that do these professional tracking of rays through optical systems. And what we're getting was that it wasn't making much difference, because as you went from the 1.8, the high index refraction ice, to the atmosphere, you had this kind of gradual transition. You had this index matching phenomena that was going on. So there wasn't much power being lost until you got to the very last transition. And then there's this very short region of 1 meter or so where the ice turns into sort of this fluffy stuff from the. That's a very low density, it turns out. So the sastrugi has very little impact on taking the directions of these events and maybe causing some kind of constructive or destructive interference.
Sure, what fluffy stuff? I didn't.
The snow on Antarctica gets laid down yearly into these kind of wave-like patterns, and most of the waves are fairly small, but there are regions where the waves are quite large, and they're called sastrugi. And so these are of order meter or so, and we thought, well, this is approximately our wavelength, this would be a problem. But the large sastrugi turn out to be only about 1% of the surface. The small sastrugi turn out to be have such low density, they don't seem to be affecting us in any appreciable way. The other thing that helps us is that we're a broadband instrument. In other words, our signal goes all the way from 200 megahertz to a gigahertz. If there is some kind of characteristic scale that causes a destructive interference phenomena, it's only at one frequency. You know, so white light interferometry is much harder than single frequency interferometry. So by averaging over all this, you seem to get very little impact by the surface characteristics. Now, so it turns out that the biggest problem is not so much the weightiness of the surface, or the, but rather just the fact that we're so close to the total internal reflection angle, that we're just off axis from that, and we're losing a lot of power. We're on this very sharp turn on near the TIR angle, and so if we're just misguessing a little bit on the characteristics of the ice in that small region as you go from 10 meters down to the surface, we could be hitting, we could be underestimating or overestimating our signal by quite a lot. So that's our next big thing that we're going to have to do, is to really make a precise measurement of how that exits the ice in realistic conditions. I think that's my opinion. We have transmitters. There's borehole not far from McMurdo.
Okay.
If I want to estimate the sensitivity to point sources, say, with the outward motion, 1 or 2 degrees, what I should do? Can you just multiply through solid angle or so? So how it, is it possible to estimate somehow?
The best thing to do is probably to talk to me or Peter Gorham about this. Because when we make these plots, what we're doing is we're averaging over an isotropic flux coming in at all angles. But in fact, we're, you know, it depends on the tilt of the Earth and what time of day we hit a particular point. So we may or may not be able to see a particular point in the sky. It depends on how the flight path goes. So if there's a source that you're interested in, we have to sort of make a probabilistic answer on how likely it is we're going to be at that point to look in that direction in the sky.
The other
problem is, for these reflected events, we're almost certainly not going to have any real pointing. So for most of the sky, we'll be able to, if there's a source out there, we're now suddenly sensitive to it. But actually being able to tell the direction, we'll have to build something else.
Is the performance of the ice going to be patchy or responsive?
Well, if we're reflected, yes. But now you're talking about the direct events, or?
No, I'm talking about the direct events.
Well,
I'm talking about this, worry about what was on in the first 10 meters. How can you know that?
We have people who study these reflection, you know, professionally. They do this all the time, and so we rely on them to tell us that when they fly. I mean, they do a pretty good job. What they do is they start at the Ross Ice Shelf, where they know what the reflection characteristics are, and then they fly up to the plateau, and then they measure how things vary, and so they can tell you, you know, if they. I have a plot where they've done all these kind of maps for it for us. It's just that it's kind of sketchy. So if I can go in.
So potentially you could actually measure the entry location, I mean the exit location of the signal, for each of the interesting events. Would that be true?
Let me answer this.
That's a related question.
This is what people have done. They made these traverses. They go and they take these, they make reflection measurements. Here's the ice shelf, here are these traverses and things. So they have pretty good information of what the ice reflection characteristics look like in these kinds of random swatches through Antarctica. And so they can tell us what fraction of sastrugi they run into, what fraction where it's not quite the same. And so this is all the information we have at the moment. And based on this information, we don't think it's going to be a big problem. But, you know, obviously, there's not a lot of information right here.
Is the biggest detector you have, that part you don't know anything about?
Right in here. This is the high spot, yeah. So people only have gone this way and up this direction. But, no, in terms of direct, this is no more special than anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Fog sleeper.
But it doesn't help us. All our events are largely within a kilometer of the surface. So for direct, we're just, you know, the event rates are more or less uniform everywhere around there.
If you flew higher, would that help?
No. In fact, going a little bit lower actually makes it a little bit more optimal. If we could get a balloon sitting at, I think Peter Gorham worked it out to 80,000 feet or something, that'd be a little bit more optimal for us. It changes, the optimal height changes on the energy. So if you have a, GZK model, where most of the events are sitting at much lower energy, then it's better to be closer to the surface.
Could you compare with Auger sensitivity of large zenith angles? Do you have such a plot?
Yes, we do.
So you are better.
But I think we're much better.
Excuse
than.
Excuse me, Auger. Auger is not.
I mean, they have several different numbers that they quote in terms of their neutrino sensitivity. For the non-tau, I think we're much better. For the tau, I think it's within an order of magnitude of the right sensitivity. But I don't know exactly what the latest. I suppose Stefan showed some results.
Yes.
Right?
Here you go.
What sets the threshold of the instrument? Because naively, the signal goes above thermal background around 10 PeV, not 1 BeV. So.
Well, it's mostly a geometry effect. You can't see events coming too close, right? Because
the height. Actually.
It's the height, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. If you want to go to lower energies, you want to bring the instrument closer to the Earth.
The GZK neutrinos are below your threshold. So if you could lower the instrument, you would catch them.
Yeah. Although, yeah.
And the flux, your five events would become much larger.
Well, we have a slightly different idea on how to do that. It's not easy to lower the instrument. I mean, balloons fly or whatever they're
flying.
No, I mean, the thing is, we're flying this. Well, we could try that, but we'll have to wait a while.
2.5 centimeters.
The better thing is, you know, this instrument, right now we're treating every antenna as a separate detector. But, you know, the military has learned long ago that that's kind of a dumb thing to do. You put them all in phased array locking, and that way you can really lower the noise. And so maybe we could fly this again with some kind of, which needs, you know, better electronics. You have to feed every signal in continuously and make sure everything stays coherently mapped on your instrument. But presumably if we can develop that, then you can lower the energy threshold by maybe a factor of 3 to 10.
I didn't understand that because I think we just concluded that the problem was not noise, it was geometry.
Well, it's
so faithful.
Well, it's geometry and the fact that your threshold has set to 3 or 5 above thermal. So if you can lower the thermal, then you can make improvements.
If your main objective is just to get cut off neutrinos, then perhaps you're in perfect place. I mean, energy band. You know, 18, 10 to 19.
Lower.
No,
I love 10 to the 19.
But 10 to 18.
Then
there is a high energy. I mean, if it goes to 21, then you
no. But the still, most of them are 2 times lower.
From the flux, you show that they peak at 5 to 18 or so.
It's not much, but it's 2 times lower.
It's a misconception that GZK is very high energy. It is. So what's your energy?
5 to 18 is pretty high.
So what determines the uncertainty? How low can you measure the energy? Is it from the spectral or the pulse? No, from the amplitude
and the distance.
There's so many uncertainties from production, transmission, reflection.
So well, we're claiming there's not so many uncertainties. At least the production, you know, there are now several computer models that now match what was measured at the at SLAC, and you know, maybe factor 50%, something like that, in terms of.
It's understood, but that's it's QED after all.
Yeah.
It's understood.
How do you measure distance?
So anyway, let me just finish this. So you know the production power, the attenuation through the ice, we think is small. I mean, we made a direct measurement of attenuation. So the only thing now is the last remaining issue is how much actually escapes out through the zone. We pretty much have that model, but we're just not sure we could, you know, stick our thumbprint on it right now. Well, it's of order unity for the most distant because it's the uncertainty of where you think this event is at the farthest place you can look. Nearer events, that 1 degree means that you can nail it to a very small distance uncertainty. So it's just going from the distance whatever little bit you have to accept from the fact that you don't know how deep it was when it, when the event occurred. So that's, that governs your energy resolution.
Yeah, in fact, I should point out, in ice, the signal comes only, it's not like in air, in ice the signal only comes from the charge separation, and that's electromagnetism, it's calculable.
And well, so it is not linear physics, in fact, it's not exactly...
The slack signal was predicted.
It's a coherent process.
A coherent process, yeah. Not exactly quantum electrodynamics, but, you know, 20 years people are arguing against this model and calculations.
No, that has to do, that's my point. That had to do with air, where there is another mechanism, which has to do with the magnetic field.
This is not dipole charge separation.
It's calculable, it was calculated and predicted, and they measured exactly what was predicted.
But no, it's charge separation, it's charge itself.
Yeah,
charge
separation. The excess of energy was in this, what's there was a torture.
Yeah, oops, yeah, it's constant scattering of atomic electrons, like if you're an electron excess.
Continuing on this question of how well you can determine the energy to do this problem, and you're very sensitive to these sort of accidental equivalent thermal reflections, can you use the possible frequency dependence of the phenomenon to get a handle on? At some level, they have a frequency dependence, and maybe 2 weeks could be useful.
We've been thinking of using frequency dependence as a way to estimate the depth, because the attenuation length does depend on frequency. So it's largely, the attenuation length is independent more or less up to 500, and you saw the number sort of decreasing as you went above 500 megahertz. So by measuring the frequency content of your pulse, if you have a pulse that you believe is sort of a canonical pulse, then you can use how much, you know, the ratio of above 500 megahertz to below 500 megahertz as a way to estimate the depth of the interaction.
And is the index of refraction enough frequency dependent?
Index of refraction, no.
But the size of the opening angle of the Cherenkov cone itself, there's some kind of frequency dependence there, right?
More frequency in one side of it than on the other?
Then the width of the chain of pulse depends on the frequency.
Yeah, it's frequency dependent.
It's frequency dependent. Yeah. So if you, right, so if you're worried about, let's say,
so
you want to determine where you are reflecting, where your full reflection or not, it depends on the angle and therefore on the frequency.
Right.
So maybe you can learn something from that.
That may be true, but we're not looking at all the frequency that comes out of this thing, right? We're limited to a band of about 200 to a gigahertz, and I don't recall a lot of variation across it at those frequencies. I mean, up at the higher frequencies, yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no,
I mean, you've plotted all the way up to like, you know, 6 or 8 gigahertz.
Yeah, the peak of from under megahertz to a gigahertz changes quite a lot.
I don't know. So maybe you can learn something from this. You said you're going to test the standard model by looking for the event rate, which I agree with. But that assumes that you have an absolute normalization for the astrophysical sources, for the GZK neutrino flux. But you showed also that you have a big uncertainty for the GZK neutrino flux.
Mm-hmm.
So this is...
No, the cross-section...
How are you going to resolve that discrepancy? I mean, how are you going to make good on your claim about the test of the standard model?
Well, the cross-section measurement depends only on the ratio of reflected to direct. So you just have to have a flux from something.
Okay, maybe we should continue question answering coffee. Thanks very much.